ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय So, page 128, 7.3, chapter 7, schedule incarnations with specific functions, Shloka Anusharanam, the chapters, verses, and summary. The first Lila avatar that Brahma glorifies is Varaha. This incarnation is Tanum Shakala Yajna Mayim Ananta, appearing with a body of identical auspices to unlimited Vedic yajnas performed in total fullness. Yet that body resembles a tusked boar. In material conception, this is an animal despicably unclean and dangerously savage. The so-called intellectual lacking a spiritual brain may dismiss the Bhagavat description of the Lila avatars as an exercise in zoomorphism, the extrapolation of divine forms from the bodies of common beasts. In fact, the forms of all gross bodies in the universe are derived from original transcendental forms exhibited by the Lord in his different pastimes. The form of Varaha is perfectly suited for the twofold challenge of the demon Hiranyaksha. First, Varahadev's mission was to lift the earth out of the Garbhodak ocean, where the demon Hiranyaksha threw it. Secondly, for halting further depredations, the miscreant had to be dispatched to the next world. With his tusks, the Lord overcame the first challenge. The second challenge was met when the primeval, yet eternal, wild boar struck the victory blow, killing the demon. Sometimes it'll be brought out so much about the particular forms that are taken in this. So they... either emphasize or overemphasize the element that you're moving through the different species like this. But that's not actually the point, because the Lord in whatever he does is perfect. So Varaha is the Lord of sacrifice, of yajna. But generally you wouldn't think of a boar as, you know, the symptom of yajna. You know, you think generally more of, you know, swans or other things like that, not a boar. So it's because he has specific, it says here, the scheduled incarnation with specific functions. So what's being brought out is the functions that the Lord is performing. Right? And the first time they are all explained in the third chapter, in the first canto, then you have qualities, you have various aspects of the pastimes, but here it's specifically bringing out what are their functions. Right? Because that means the Lord, when he does something, there's always a function. Right? There's a result. That is necessary, because we're seeing we're going through this whole process here. In the first canto, we brought out that the living entity needs to give up its position of the controller and enjoyer. So if you're the controller, then that means safety is important, right? Because you control to be safe, right? That's the platform. In Sambandha, then fear is the principle there. The mundane principle, and that is good control. So a misapplication of the sambandha, then you get this fear and the controlling tendency. But within sambandha is relationship. So sambandha means your safety. Right? Does that make sense? It means if relationship is there, you're confident. Everything works nicely in that. So if others aren't doing it, then one does it oneself. So here is wanting to be God, then that's one of the principles we work on. So now if we're going to relinquish that endeavor to God himself, then we have to have confidence that God is going to protect us. Right? Therefore, when we open in the first canto, the first appearance of the Lord is saving Uttara. saving Parikshit. Right? So we see how he's saving the Pandavas. Right? So then, okay, then we could understand that. Then after that, then an enjoyer is that, okay, if we're going to surrender to the Lord, then also, okay, if I'm not the enjoyer, but it should be that still enjoyment is there. Right? I still am going to be happy. And so we see that his ability for enjoyment is much greater. He has 16,108 wives. See, so many things are happening there. And they're all happy. They're all satisfied. Right? So that's important. Okay, he has 16,108 wives. That means, you know, that's a lot of, you know, household fights. Right? But we don't hear of that. We just hear of everything going very nicely. Right? Very nice. He has 10 children, you know, from each wife. So that means attraction is there. Otherwise, there's no children. You know? So then everything's running nicely. So that means he's doing his duties well. Right? So not only is he protecting, but he's creating the facility by which the living entity will be happy. Does that make sense? Right? So here we see another then quality. That's it. The Lord does things, right? So Munda's in place, then we need to see that, okay, that's there. So then you're thinking, you're feeling willing, though, is then that must give a result, must give an activity, you know, there's an activity is there that gives a result, right? So we dealt with Sambandha, we dealt with Prayojana. So here's an example of Abhideya. Right? Means the specific functions. He does get things done. Right? He's not just somebody who just has nothing to do. But he actually, in his performance of duties, results happen. Right? So further than strengthening this element of that the Sambandha and Prayojana is strong. It's okay to surrender to this person. Right? They will take care, they'll provide, everything will be nice. Right? So therefore we see is that these different things come. Okay, and in verse 2, next Brahma chants the glories of Suyagya, who, Nimisha, as we have already seen in Bhagavatam 1.3.12, was fathered by Prajapati Ruchi in the womb of his mother Akuti. Suyagya is also known as Yagya, and Hari personally assumed the throne of heaven of heavenly king Indra to keep order in the cosmos during the Manvantar devastation that fell between the age of Swayambhuva and Svarochisha. Right, the Lord will take up means he's expanded into everything. So universal form is showing this. The Purushukta confirmed is proving this, that the Lord is has entered everything. He makes everything work. It's his potency that's making it happen. As we remember before, he's the Adiatmic. Right? And from him, the Adi Daivik is simply his expansion, his potencies. Right? Then that comes down to our level, the Adi Bhautik. Right? So if there is no Jiva to take up a post in the Adi Daivik, then he takes it himself. Right? So here's an example where Suyagya then took the post of Indra because there was no one else. There was not an Indra that was qualified. Right? Like he'll do that, sometimes he'll take the position of Brahma also, or, you know, whatever needs to be done, because you're working within generally, you know, those within the universe, and then you have to have the pious qualities to take that up. But you're talking about 33 million posts. Generally, there's never any problem, but if there is, the Lord takes that up. Right? So in other words, then he also proves maintenance, that he's going to make things work. Right? So that's also very important, because whatever you have, you want it to stay. So it also gives more faith in the Lord's protective power, right? Because this is a point that's brought out in a Mahapurana, Poshanam, right? Is he takes care, he nourishes. Does that make sense? Because there's the element that you have to have faith that God's going to take care, because otherwise we take care ourselves. Right? That's the natural state. That if a girl is protected, then she always depends upon the males of the family. But if she's not protected, then she will do it herself. Right? And it'll be actually very hard to convince her that now others are willing to do it. Right? So it's a slow process. So again and again, this has to be brought out, how if we surrender to the Lord, then one doesn't have to worry. He's taking care of us. Right? Because otherwise, if anything goes wrong in our perception, then immediately, oh, Krishna's not taking care. We do things, things go wrong, it's always someone else's fault. Right? So in the same way as, okay, but here someone else is doing it, but it's their fault. Right? If we follow the formula perfectly, then I'm endeavoring to take care of myself, something goes wrong, it's someone else's fault. So if God's taking care of me, if something goes wrong, it's still someone else's fault. Right? In either case, I'm not to blame if I'm taking care. God shouldn't be to blame if he's taking care. But somehow or another, he's to blame when he's taking care. Right? If things go wrong. Does that make sense? So we're trying to get beyond that, that we see that how he's taking care. Right? What is taking care? Because otherwise, we see the Pandavas now in there, Krishna's taking care. But are there no difficulties? Right? Because our idea of taking care would be this perfect little place where nothing ever goes wrong. Right? Isn't it? No, you can see this when people come door to door and they come with the little pamphlets and all that. Then they have this, if you look in their little pamphlet, then they have these little nice pictures of people have gone to heaven. And, you know, there's everybody's happy and smiling and all the animals talk and, you know, always the little daughter is there cuddling with a big lion and, you know, it's always there, you know, like this. So they don't know, nothing goes wrong, but the point is everything goes right, but that wouldn't work. It works for God, right? It's called Atmarama. Nothing ever goes wrong. Right? Does that make sense? But the living entity, something has to go wrong. It's just the way they are made. Because being dependent means you have to be confident of that dependence. So, therefore, even if everything's going right, you have to create a situation in which it appears everything's falling apart. And then putting it back together, then you're confident that everything's all right now. Does that make sense? Yeah? It's just the way it is. So, therefore, things go wrong only because God's dealing with the living entities. On his own, if he's just dealing with himself, that's called Atmaram, nothing goes wrong. Right? Of course, nothing happens, but nothing goes wrong. But as soon as you introduce the living entities, then there's always something has to change, something has to be different, something has to, it can never be the same. Right? So in the spiritual world, everything always works out fine and this and that. You reflect that in the material world, things don't always work out all right on the material platform. So what needs to be seen is that the material world is not going to change because I've surrendered to God. What's going to change is my perception of it and the effect that it actually has upon me. Does that make sense? That's what's going to change. Right? Let us say I go out for a walk and it's been a really bad day for me and slightly depressed. Don't really see any, don't have a plan to work anything out. And while I'm out walking, I'm a little too far away to easily get back very quickly. It starts to rain. Right? So it's just going to make things worse, right? Just really now feel bad, and then you just kind of turn around and slosh your way back to wherever it was, and like that. Now let us say it's an extremely good day. I've just heard something that would make me very happy that we've been, you know, planning for, working for a long time. Finally it's gotten. And if it starts to rain, I couldn't care less, you know. Then you get wet, then you just start to dance and, you know, be crazy. And does that make sense? So that's the point, is that it's just perception whether you take it as good or bad. So everything appears, everything maintains, everything disappears in the material world. It's just the way it is. So how you perceive it, then you will gain benefit from it, or you won't. That's what Krishna consciousness is. Right? Of course, there is the added element just for our benefit that if you perform things, if pious activity is performed, generally your material situation is better. But always remember that pious is what sets it up. You will do more pious activities, but you're still having to deal with your past. That's what's coming at present. Right? So I've done the pious activity now. That result will come. But when? It may take some time to mature, right? You put a seed in the ground. It's not that you have a tree there that you can eat mangoes off immediately. It takes time, right? It takes 5-6 years, and then it'll get some mangoes. Then as it gets older, it'll start giving more and more. Does that make sense? Right? So just because I perform the pious activity right now doesn't mean the result comes now. But it's auspicious, the mentalities come. What I'm dealing with is what I've done in the past and what that will come to me now. Does that make sense? So because I perform pious activities, then yes, I may have a more pious outlook on the results of my previous activities, but I may not. So I will be maybe negatively influenced. Right? So the point is Krishna consciousness, then as it matures, then we get that benefit where we are unaffected by the results of the pious or impious activities. We're always equal poised, always Krishna conscious. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
What if someone says this makes human psychology supreme and God is just a figment of your imagination to justify, you know, thinking that everything's good?
This makes human psychology supreme and God a figment of the imagination. It's not a logical statement, because if you're working off that because of what you've done you're getting the result, and therefore human psychology becomes supreme, you might have something to discuss about. But then in the same breath to say that therefore God's a figment, but who's making those arrangements anyway? If psychology is supreme, that means it's a science. That means it's not chance. It means somebody's operating it. Who is that person who operates it for everybody? Right? You know, is it the, what do you call it? The Illuminati? Or who are the 3-foot tall guys and with pinstripe suits in Zurich that manage the world?
Rachel?
Oh, okay. You know, like that. So, I mean, you know, we have so many conspiracy theories who's running the world, but is that counted in this psychological thing? Because otherwise, then, it was a nice sentimental point by the human psychologist to finally, his thing is supreme and not nuclear physics, and he's being told by the nuclear physicist that his science is not actually a science and it's just a bunch of junk. And finally he can, you know, raise up and exert, you know, how you say, exhibit his ego, saying yes. But it doesn't mean that he's become God in the process. So the point is Krishna says it's because of what the living entity does that that's what you're getting. But it's still the options that what you can do is still managed by God. Right? You still have to eat, you still breathe air, you still sleep. Eating, sleeping, mating, defending is going on. The 5 rasas are going on. Right? Past, present, future, you know, or going hankering, lamenting, you know, being satisfied. These are all still points with which you function, and they're not changed whether you have noted them by, you know, modern psychology or not. They still remain. So they were here before modern psychology came, they'll be here after it's gone. Right? So that means someone is managing all this. It's not chance. If you say it's chance, then what's the meaning of your psychology? Your psychology is science because it's not chance. You know? So you can't have your cake and eat it too. You can't say, well, it's all chance, so then what you're saying is nonsense and can't say supreme. Say this is supreme. Yes, that's supreme, but there's somebody supreme operating that supreme. It may be supreme in your destiny, but there's still someone making sure that that happens. Right? And it's not that there's not something beyond. And so, therefore, if that person is doing that, there must be a purpose, right? No one does anything without a purpose. So So what is their purpose that they're giving you the results of your activities? You know, why would they bother doing that unless there was some further purpose? Right? Their care for you, affection for you, they're going to get something for you. You know, you're going to, you know, whatever it is, sell them your soul or something you're going to get out of it, right? So then that means then there's a purpose to the universe. So then what is that? Who is that purpose person and what is the purpose? That should be the conclusion of any science. Right? Just because they figured out how something works doesn't mean that now their science works at the exclusion of all the other sciences. And that the person who has given that science and operates it doesn't have any meaning. And why would all those sciences be there unless there was a purpose to them? Does that make sense? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Brahma recounts the pastime of Lord Kapiladev, appearing as the 10th child and only son of Kardama Muni, and the most fortunate Devahuti. He personally delivered his mother by teaching her the science of self-realization in the form of Bhagavat Sankhya Darshana. This, the God-given Sankhya philosophy, investigates Prakriti, material nature, and Purusha, primarily the supreme enjoyer, secondly, his imitators from among the marginal parts and parcels of the Lord. The goal, Atmagati, is the fallen soul's salvation and ultimate perfection, eternal loving servitude to Purushottam Sri Krishna. So here is its complete, Sankhya then will be a philosophy. So we see here, just in a nutshell, it's been given complete, that it defines what is the Brahman, what is the soul, what is the material nature, what's their relationship. Then how the goal, how to get out, and that goal is eternal loving servitude to the Lord, to Krishna. Right? So it's a complete philosophy, because the philosophy must have these five parts. Otherwise it's not considered complete. Sambandha in the form of Chit Achit Ishwara, right? Then the Abhideya, the process by which the living entity will liberate themselves. And the fifth is then what is the state of being of that living entity once he is liberated, right? That's why we always see that it's perfection, eternal loving servitude. It doesn't just say he's liberated. We'd never stop there, because getting out of the material world is not liberation, right? Because the soul will come back, so it's not considered liberation. But the soul goes, develops love for Krishna, goes to the spiritual realm, then that's liberation, right? The Brahmavadis will say you just get out of the material world, emerge in the Brahman. The yogis will say emerge in Paramatma. Right? They all have their different ideas, or you know, something to do with Shiva, or you just become void, or, you know, that makes all your different philosophies. But what is the state of being of the living entity once he is freed from the material entanglement? Right? Then you'll say that's their philosophy, right? So then you have a process for that, and to do that, then they have to have a definition of the soul, God, and the material energy. Does that make sense? So that's a complete process. So if you're ever discussing, then you know that if these points are covered, then you've made a proper presentation, right? And you can find, and how you understand what someone else is speaking, their strength or weakness will lie in, you know, the clarity and the correctness of their giving these five points. Does that make sense? Yeah. Okay. The Lord reciprocated with Atri Muni's fatherly devotion by accepting the sage as his own father. Long, long before the advent of Shankaracharya and his Mayavad philosophy, the Dattatreya avatar was a great expounder of Nirvisesh Gyan, Nimisha. The specific name for Lord Dattatreya's doctrine is to be found in Bhagavatam 8.3.12. It's fourth verse. So the idea of everything's Brahman has always been there, right? But in here, is we will also say everything's Brahman, but of Brahman, then we're interested in that person who is the source of all the Brahman. Does that make sense? Right? It's all Brahman, but that doesn't mean we don't make distinction within Brahman. Does that make sense? Right? You go to a table, it's all food. But you do make distinction between what you consider as superior and inferior food. Right? So in the same way as you're dealing with Brahman, that doesn't mean that there's not variety in Brahman, and we take within that the superior form of worshipping the Supreme Lord. Does that make sense? So the platform of everything's Brahman is not a problem, right? Because otherwise one might say, well, why is the Lord propagating that? The problem is that your definition of Brahman, meaning that it's all one, and that the soul after liberation is one with Brahman with no relationship, right? But here you can say one merges into Brahman or one, you know, like that, but meaning that you merge into the pastimes of the Lord's, with the Lord and the devotees, and interact on that platform. So you become on that platform of that Brahman. You know what I'm saying? So we could describe Vaishnavism using these Upanishadic terminologies that would appear to be impersonal, right? But it's not actually. It's just how you define, how do you define all these different things. Does that make some sense? Yeah. Next, Narad hears about the Chatushana avatar appearing as Brahma's own offspring. Has four brahmachari brothers whose features never age beyond those of five-year-olds, yet who are incarnations of the Supreme Lord's Jnana Shakti. The Chatushana come to the aid of the sages whose knowledge was lost due to the cosmic devastation after an earlier period of creation. The expert teachings of the four sannas restore spiritual vision to the Vedic civilization. So there's always someone to give this knowledge, right? It'll always be there. It never disappears. It becomes hidden, but there's always, if someone wants, it's always available. Right? Like we see Bhaktivinoda Thakur. It took him 7 years to find a Chaitanya Charitamrita. Right? So basically it disappeared, but it wasn't that because of the sincerity that the knowledge was not found. Does that make sense? So one of the aspects of bringing out here is the four Kumaras. Then they, being the Jnana Shakti of the Lord, the incarnations, then they bring that back into the civilization anytime it's lacking. And anytime it's there, then they add to it. Like we'll see many of the conversations in the Bhagavatam are with the four Kumaras, right, with Sanat Kumar. Murti Devi, daughter of Prajapati Daksha, right? Oh, another aspect, but is the spiritual vision in the Vedic civilization. That's the most important. The civilization is there, but the spiritual vision is what's important. Does that make sense? Because otherwise you have the form of it, and having the form of it, if you're not able to understand the actual purpose behind it, the spiritual purpose behind it, the adhyatmic, then all the other understandings don't have real meaning. Right? So that's why it's very important that the knowledge is there. Also, anything that's performed, an activity performed with knowledge, then gives you a better result. And if it's performed with detachment, then it liberates you from the material clutches. Right? So knowledge and activity go together. Right? Because an activity done without knowledge won't give a result, so therefore it can't be avideya, because it's not giving you prayojana. Avideya gives prayojana. That means the activity must be done with knowledge that it's the correct activity that fits the field and what you want to gain from that field. Right? Does that make sense? Right? If you don't know the field of activities and what you can get from it, then you won't also know what activity to perform to get what result from that field. Does that make sense? Right? So knowledge is an integral part of activity. Right? That's why playing is, you know, it doesn't necessarily have anything to get done other than just to have a good time. So it does that, but as far as getting a specific work done, it doesn't. Right? That's why it's called playing. Right? Does that make sense? Yeah. Murti Devi, daughter of Prajapati Daksha and wife to Dharma personified, gave birth to the twin incarnation of Nara Narayan Rishi. Cupid and a bevy of apsaras sent by Indra try to deviate the sages from their vows. But Lord Narayana lightheartedly foiled the scheme by producing from his internal potency a multitude of women more beautiful than Indra had ever seen. Because Indra is working with the apsaras, right? Like that. And so they're of this world of normal piety that's here. So then they came and tried to deviate them, because Indra is always worried about his position, right? Because he's done his sacrifices, so he'll be there for the time allotted. But he's worried if anybody else does, then they'll come and kick him out. Means if they had the potency, they could, but it means if they're pious, then they wouldn't, right? They'd wait for their turn, right? Like Bali Maharaj is the next Indra, right? And so like that, he's waiting. But here then, Indra always gets a little worried about it, because his enjoyment's so great, he gets overly attached to it. So anytime there might be a loss, then he gets disturbed, right? So that shows he's not exactly what you call Atmarama, right? He's dependent upon his facility for his happiness. So then he sends the Cupid and the Apsaras, and then it says in a lighthearted, mood, then he produces from his thigh so many, you know, like apsaras, you know, but they're coming from his potency. And the beauty of them is so much greater than anything here that Indra's ever seen. So besides foiling their plan that they all gave up, means the apsaras themselves are feeling ashamed because they weren't as beautiful as these ones that have been produced, right? They're trying to seduce a sage who produces girls more beautiful than them, so it's kind of like they have no meaning to this sage, right? You know, they think that because he would go with the best, right? If Indra goes personally, it means he's going with the best. So he would be taking, you know, Rumba and Menaka and these ones. But nothing happens, right? So that, and he produces ones that are better than them. So they're just sitting there embarrassed and feeling ashamed that they even tried. Indra is sitting there just, you know, gawking at them and just thinking, wow, like this. And so then they all go back, you know, after, you know, everybody's gotten the point, and while Indra's bewildered, right, then they all go back into his thigh. And it's only as the last one is going back into his thigh, he kind of like comes out of his stupor, you know, and says, wait, one, get one, like that, you know. So then that's Urvasi. Because Ur means thigh. Uru tarasya yad vaishya, right? The vaishyas come from the thighs. Urvasi means she had already entered, meant one, they come from the thigh, but it entered that she'd started to step back in, you know? And so then she was given to Indra. So when they talk about the five big apsaras, Urvasi's not one of the five. She's outside that category. Right? She's in her own category. So the Lord is showing that, you know, he's not deviated by these things. Yes.
In what sense is Narayana Rishi one person?
How is Narayana Rishi one person? The Lord and his energies are non-different. The Lord and the Jiva means they're different in that you see their separate forms, that their purpose is one. Right? Like that. Also, the reason they appeared was the demon had gotten the benediction that he could only be killed by a person who was simultaneously in deep trance and meditation and fighting, you know, with physical arms. So that's an impossibility. You know, it's like Hiranyakashipu, you know, not in the nighttime, not in the day, not on land, not in the air, not in the water, you know, like all these things. So not inside, not outside. So he thought he had everything covered, but, you know, Krishna's more smart than that, right? You know, so then, in the same way as then Naranarayan come as one person, accounted as one Rishi. It's Naranarayan Rishi, not Rishis. Right? So Nara, then he, meditated, and Narayana then fought with the demon. And I know of that this demon was, he had a benediction of 100 kavachas, you know, that were actually part of his body. And if one was destroyed, the next one would just appear. So like that, then the Lord, destroyed 99 of those kavachas. And then when the last one appeared, then he just killed him without destroying the Kavacha. So he still had one more to go. So then that demon, the next birth, we know him as, how do you say? Radheya. Yeah? As Karna. So that's why he has a special relationship with Krishna and Arjuna. Because they're Naranarayan. Right? So. Some very accomplished mystics among them, Shiva is foremost, are able to vanquish Kamadev by their wrathful glances. But such great yogis are helpless against the onslaught of reaction that the release of such terrible anger generates. Brahma points out that the Lord's mind cannot be penetrated by anger. How then, he asks, can his heart be penetrated by lust? Okay, now here's a very important point. Now, usually by this next verse, then it's bringing out the purpose that's being pointed here. Why lightheartedly, right? Understand? If you're angry, you don't do anything lightheartedly. So because anger couldn't overcome the Lord, therefore lust, how would it even have a chance? Understand? Because anger and lust are connected. Because anger is frustration after lust can't be fulfilled. Right? So, then you see that the, how you say, materialist, they perform an activity with the idea of enjoying the senses. They can't enjoy the senses, they become angry. Right? But, yeah. Does that make sense? The sage controls the senses so he's not enjoying, but it still produces that same anger. But they control that anger so they have, it gives power. Does that make sense? But we see here is in the case of Lord Shiva, then he's the best of all mystics, and when Kamadev came and harassed him, he burnt him to ashes with a glance. Right? Because of anger. Does that make sense? But Krishna didn't even become angry. He just lightheartedly thought, you know, you guys are a joke. You know, you think you're going to get me with these, you know, these wallahs. You know, check out these girls that I produce. You know, and so then it's like he just very jokingly dealt with it. So no anger. So you can understand. There's no question of being able to, you know, conquer. You know, because by controlling, then anger may be produced, right? But even higher is if there's no anger, that means there's no question. So like when Markandeya Rishi, Indra pulled the same thing with Markandeya, but got no reaction, right? He went with, you know, the spring personified and everything, and musicians and the dancers, and, you know, Kamadev, you know, everything was perfect, and Kamadev shot his arrows, and no reaction from Markandeya. So then immediately the thought, well, no reaction means he's not going to be overwhelmed by lust. But as a sage, anger is still there. Right? So then they immediately packed up and split very quickly before he could, you know, burn them to ashes. Because they've already been through this, you know. You know, Kamadev kind of knows the cycle. The upsars also, one of the main things, they always get worried when Indra tells them to go and do this, because some of them have ended up as little piles of ashes, so, like that, you know. Like that. So therefore, one controls anger, right? That's why it's mentioned the six pushings. The mind, and then that'll control the anger. You control the tongue, what you speak, that will control, the mind will control anger. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
Is it also like that one who is satisfied with whatever situation comes, then also the anger doesn't arrive?
Because in the beginning you're trying to mechanically control the senses. But that's because you have particular desires and you're not fulfilling them for a higher purpose. But eventually it comes where you don't want or need those desires. So at that time, then it creates a peacefulness where then there is no anger. You know what I'm saying? So that's why the importance of controlling and control of the senses is to work on removal also of desire. Right? Otherwise, anger will come. Right? It has to. Because whatever you do in the material world, there's always some frustration. You're going to have to deal with it. So to control oneself in those situations means anger will arise. Right? And so if you just want to be angry all day because the material energy is such that there's always something to be angry about, that's, you can do that. But it's mentioned that best is come to a point where of satisfaction where one isn't worried, right? You know, I can come to that platform of Naishkarmi, that these are the duties to perform, they are performed, and, you know, good or bad result, or things working smoothly or not, that's not my concern. My concern is to do the best within this framework. You know the situation, yes.
Is it actually when the anattas are not in the heart, so then the situation doesn't agitate, so one can peacefully handle basically anything, because the desire is not there.
Yeah. 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 It means that will be on the gross. That'll get you from the kanista to the madhyam. But still, you still have to worry about the position of the subtle, dhanam janam sundarim. You still have to worry about I am advanced. I'm, you know, leader of devotees. These also have to be overcome, because these also can create anger. They're subtler. You know? Generally, someone who's more advanced runs into less problem. But if they do, it's still there. You know? You're walking down the street, you're doing parikram, and a bus is coming along behind, right? You know, on the Srup Ganj road, you know? So you move over for the bus to pass. So you're doing what you should do, you know, but the, you know, one of those guys that work on the bus, you know, the guy that bangs the side and goes, hey, hey, side, or somebody, you know, leans out and gives you a bonk on the head as they go by. They shouldn't be doing that. You're on parikram, you're a devotee, but they do it anyway. So then, naturally, what arises is anger, because you think, I'm to be respected. You know, I'm a devotee, why are they doing this? This is nonsense. I'm doing parikram, why? What's their problem? Right? So it's subtler, but it still is an element. Right? Yeah, so if there's satisfaction, there's less anger. So this principle comes up less. Means it's the main focus on sense control and being sensitive to others' needs, because then that will have a tendency to correct that. But still, they have to work on it. The women have to be satisfied, because for them, being insulted is so much easier. Right? Anything that's not normal insults women. Right? Urvasi mentions in the ninth canto, women are very easily insulted. So therefore, there's much more opportunity for them to be angry. So they practice satisfaction, then that will help counteract that. Does that make sense? But that's a general principle for any living entity, because all living entities are feminine by nature, so it still applies to everybody. Is that okay? Hmm?
Anger is controlled, and how is that energy resolved?
Anger is controlled, how it resolved means it's controlled by forgiveness. Right? And so then, even though there's an opportunity to come up because there's forgiveness, then it doesn't. So in the beginning it may come up, then you forgive, but at some point one's in a forgiving mood that as the opportunity could come up, it's gone already. You know what I'm saying? It's like the difference between, it's practice. and maturity. It's like the difference in the 18th chapter of the Gita where it talks about renunciation, tyag, and sannyas. Tyag means you perform the activity with desire for the result, you get the result, you give it away. Right? But sannyas means it's already given away before it comes. So you're working without a desire for result. So that means then, because the forgiveness is there, it's already there. So before anger can arise, it's already gone. Because the person's been forgiven even before they've done anything wrong. You understand? Like that. So anger is, then goes. Yeah. And this forgiveness also applies on oneself. That doesn't mean one's not remorseful, but one forgives oneself.
Can you give an example for that?
Person's already forgiven before he's made an offense. The Avantipur Brahmin, when he took sannyas, then he'd go out and do his duties, he'd beg and all that, and he'd go outside the village, sit down to eat whatever he'd get. So the local village punks decide to come along, have some fun, they steal his danda, this, that. You know, sometimes they'll pass urine on, you know, the food that he's collected and have a good laugh and all this kind of thing. And what to do? That's life. You know. So he's not bothered. Sukadev Goswami. You know, he has all these, you know, village kids coming and laughing and gawking and that like that. So he's not disturbed.
You were also mentioning that by controlling anger we get power. So that means by controlling any other senses we get power. Maybe that's why we have the ability to make the whole world
decide. Yeah. No, I mean, it was powerful, but beyond that, more a better situation is that of being, you know, fully surrendered to Krishna. Right? So, that being the purpose, then it goes to another stage, a mature stage. Just like the best of human, it means of all living entities, very few are humans. Of those who are humans, very few are civilized. Of those civilized, very few are interested in the actual higher knowledge that the Vedic civilization is offering. Of those, very few endeavor for it. Of those who endeavor, very few actually persevere and get it. Of those who get it, very few realize what it's for. Right? So then in this, then you see is that you have a human, best of that is the Brahman. The best of the Brahmins is the Vaishnava. Right? So in the same way is that controlling the senses, that's good. That the senses want to move, you're controlling them. That's good, but better than that is when that matures where there's no interest for anything to do with this, with the, what do you call it? Senses. Does that make sense? Because one has transferred that to the transcendental senses. Yeah? Okay. The small prince Dhruva entered the forest to perform the severest austerities after being insulted by his co-mother Suruchi in the presence of his father. His birth mother Suniti advised him to seek out the Lord where the sages find him, in the forest of austerities. By the mercy of Narad Muni, Dhruva Maharaj received initiation into transcendental knowledge, austerity, and the chanting of the Lord's holy name. Only 6 months later, young Dhruva was more powerful than the host of demigods, who begged the Lord to oblige the boy to cease his austerities. The whole creation was choking for breath on his austerities. Means he just went through, you know, his different things, and at the last he just stopped breathing. That means he started off eating only, you know, a little bit, then rarely, then he stopped eating, and then he's drinking water, stops drinking that, and then eventually stopped breathing air. So when he stopped breathing air, then the whole universe is finding it difficult to breathe. The Lord, in his Krishnagarbha avatar form, awarded the boy the planet Dhruva, which means imperishable. Visible in the night as Polaris, Dhruva Loka is actually a Vaikuntha planet, the abode of Kiradaksha Vishnu. So he sees the focus is what's important, and then of focus, that focus on the Lord. Yes. Because, see, you're dealing with the universal form, everything that's going on. And so everything's actually connected, right? So you're dealing with all the adibhotic is depending upon the adidaivik, right? All the demigods control all the activities of the world. Those are controlled by the adiatmic, the Lord. So he's so absorbed in the Lord that all his activities are connected to the Lord, that therefore even his breathing is connected to the Lord. And the Lord is the Lord of the breathing. When the universal form breathes, everything breathes. When he doesn't, it doesn't. So therefore even his breathing comes on that platform. It didn't say that they couldn't breathe means at all, but it was getting very difficult. You know, it was not easy. Does that make some sense? So that's the point, is that this whole second canto basically is showing the position of the Lord in the material creation as a universal form, and how the devotee can use that understanding to free themselves from material entanglement. Right? Because that material entanglement is coming because we see everything, or we see things separately from the Lord. But when you understand that it's non-different from the Lord, then that connection is made. So if it is the Lord, then you should deal with it according to how the Lord says it should be dealt with, right? If I think it's not the Lord, then whether I follow God's laws in dealing with it, it may or may not be important to me. But if what I'm dealing with is God, and God's given rules how to deal with that portion of the creation, then I would have a tendency to follow those rules in dealing with that. Then whatever taste that I wanted to get from interacting with the material elements in that way, I will get, and more, because it's complete, because you're dealing with the Lord. But at the same time, it's still that taste that I'm getting is coming through the material elements. But it's not actually material elements, the taste that I'm getting. Right? It's not necessarily, how you say, spiritual, but it's the, you know, the adibhotic adiatmic element of, I mean, the adidaivik adiatmic element of the adibhotic. Does that make sense? I think it's a material energy, but it's not. So then, in the beginning, I'll be very happy with that, and absorbed in that, and, you know, doing everything, connecting to Krishna. But after a while, because the nature of the material energy, material results always go down. So then you start to notice that what is there is actually, then you can compare between the Lord and the activity itself. So the Lord as the experience and the working principle of that activity, and the dead matter that activity and results are coming through, I start can, you know, more clearly see the difference. And then we see, because of it, the lesser nature of, even though it's the Lord, it's lesser than if I was dealing with the Lord directly in the form of his name, form, qualities, pastimes, the deity, like that. Then you start to see as well, actually I could deal there better. That's why just performing the activities of sadhana in the way of, you know, controlling the senses and all that, if you're not cultivating the attraction to Krishna, is not so important. Because otherwise, once you are liberated, then where will you go? The living entity has to go from one shelter of the senses to another. And if it's not the Lord, because you're attracted to dealing with the Lord directly, as opposed to dealing with the Lord indirectly through the universal form, you're not going to make that choice. So that's why they both have to be cultivated together. So this chapter brings that out, you know? And so then here's an element where we see is that he's so connected to the Lord, his focus is so great, that the Lord who is, because the Lord breathes, the universe breathes, therefore he's affecting the breathing of the universe. That makes sense? Like that. So even though these are very technical and seemingly dry things, they're only dry as long as it's technique and you don't see the Lord in it. But once you even see the Lord as a universal form in whatever you're dealing with, then it takes on a different flavor. And once it becomes situated in that, then the seeing the difference between the direct activities of service to the Lord and the indirect activities start to become noticeable. Does that make sense? Then it takes you to another level of taste. Does that make sense? But in the beginning, we're having to deal with intellectually, that's what we got when we're dealing with it. Because we may not have the taste yet. Right? You know, nishta is first, then ruchi. Right? You situate yourself nicely, you follow it properly, then ruchi will come. Does that make sense? Yeah? Okay. Anything else? Otherwise, we'll continue tomorrow. Okay, yeah. Gantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki, Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivrinda ki, Jainatai Gaura Premanandi.